Tampa. Roll the tape, please. My name is Rick Dunning. I am a geographer and geologist, and I live in Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach both of those subjects on the college level at St. Olaf College and at a Normandale Community College in Minneapolis. The title of today's session is Soil is Not Just Dirt. And I hope in the brief comments that I make this afternoon, I can give you some appreciation for soil and its importance as a resource. In fact, I would say that soil is one of our most vital resources. If you think a moment about the things that we need to live, first and foremost, we need oxygen to breathe. We wouldn't last more than a few minutes without oxygen. Water, we have to have to drink, and we wouldn't last more than a couple of days without water. And food, we need food, and most of us wouldn't last more than a couple of weeks without food. There have been some stories of longer times, but food is one of the basic necessities for life, and virtually all of our food comes from the soil. Now, the food that doesn't maybe is seafood, but for most of us, particularly in the Midwest, the large part of our diet comes from soil. It doesn't come from Safeway, doesn't come from the A&P store, it comes from soil, at least originally. Now, if you think about that, first, plants all grow in the soil, and plants are our most important food source. Fruit, vegetables, grains, all come from soil. And all the feed that goes to cattle and hogs and chickens and turkeys also comes from soil. So ultimately, all of our meat also comes from soil. So we need to treat our soil with respect and with some amount of care if we wish to continue using it as a resource. Now, soil is more complex than most of us think about from day to day. Soil is in part ground up rock material or broken up rock material, and part of it is organic matter from plants that's mixed in with that rock material, and part of soil is air. There's a lot of air space in soil that most of us don't think about, holes and cracks and that sort of thing. So much of the volume of soil is actually air. One thing that's important to realize is that soil forms. It is created out of material that is not originally soil. So it must go through a process of formation. Now, since we can't go out and look at the soil today, I brought some in for us to look at here. This is not soil, this is a rock. You can tell that pretty easily. But initially, all the material that our soil forms in has to come from this rock. And this is a black and white speckled rock, kind of a diorite, is what we would call it in geologic terms. And the minerals that make up this rock gradually go through a decomposition process. The minerals inside the rock will break apart, and as those minerals decompose, the rock breaks into smaller and smaller pieces. Eventually, it decomposes to the point where we have silt and clay, which are very fine soil particles, and sand, which are coarser soil particles. Now, I have some of this decomposing rock here in this bag. Essentially, it's the same material that makes up this rock, but it's been broken down, decomposed into smaller particles. I'll pass both of these around so you can compare the solid rock with the decomposed rock. In addition to that decomposed rock material, the other major source of soil material in this valley and in much of the Midwest, if you're from the Midwest, comes from glacial deposits. glaciers that moved through this area, and as they moved through, the glaciers would grind up the rock into smaller and smaller pieces, and when the ice melts, that glacial debris is just left behind. And that glacial debris gives us valuable material for soil to form in. So this is some of the glacial sediments that were deposited here in this valley. Now, none of this is soil yet. We're still talking about just ground up pieces of rock. That's all we've got. That ground up rock material has to be turned into soil by the action of soil forming processes. Now, let me draw just a couple of things on the board quickly. One thing that's important to realize is that soil forms at the boundary between the solid rock of the earth, which we'll pretend is down here, and the air of the atmosphere. So the soil is that boundary zone between the earth and the atmosphere, and really forms as a result of the interaction between the earth and the atmosphere. Now, there are four general types of processes that create the soil. Some things are added to this loose rock material that we're looking at in the little bags here. Some things get added to that. Some other soil particles and organic matter get moved around within the soil. Some other soil particles and organic matters will be washed out of the soil by the movement of water down through the rock material. In addition to that, there are a variety of chemical transformations that take place within the soil. One thing becomes something else, if you will. Now, through the action of these soil forming processes, we get the development of layers within the soil. So a soil, when we talk about soil, it has a three-dimensional characteristic to it. Not only is it two-dimensional in terms of the space it takes up on the surface of the earth, but the soil also extends downward from the surface of the earth in the third dimension. Now, these layers within the soil are called horizons. This means that the soil has layers in it. The uppermost horizon is known as the A horizon. The lower horizon is known as the B horizon. This is a code system that soil scientists have. There are some other horizons that sneak in here somewhere. There's sometimes an E horizon in between. There's sometimes a K horizon in there. But basically, the soil consists of the A horizon, the B horizon, which normally we would refer to as the topsoil and the subsoil. So the topsoil and subsoil form through the action of the soil forming processes. Water and plant material that get worked into the surface of the soil create the topsoil, and then the movement of soil particles and chemicals within the soil will also create the subsoil. Below the subsoil is everything that is not soil, or what we would call parent material. The parent material is this loose rock material we've been passing around that the soil forms in. Now, I have a bag of soil here, and I'll pass that around. And think back to the bag of glacial material you looked at. That was kind of a light brown color. This is a dark gray brown. It's got a lot of roots in it, and it's got a lot of organic matter mixed into the soil. So pass that around, and that is actual soil. It is created from the loose rock material we looked at earlier, particularly the glacial material. But in addition to that loose rock material, there's also the organic matter, the plant material, together with the air space that we talked about. Now, the processes that create soil are controlled by the environment. So they're controlled by the climate in a particular location. They're controlled by the topography or the landscape in a particular location. They're controlled by the kind of parent material that the soil forms in, the kind of rock material that's originally there. They're controlled by the kinds of plants that are in that particular location. And also, soil is formed by the action of worms and other kinds of organisms that burrow into the soil and mix it up and take that organic matter, the loose plant material from the surface, and work it into the topsoil. Now, the operation of these processes within a unique environment creates a unique soil in each location. You can identify one soil from another by the kind of soil horizons that are present in the soil. In the United States alone, there are over 10,000 different kinds of soil. I don't know them all yet, and I'm not sure that anybody does, but there are well over 10,000 kinds of soil, and the way you tell one soil from another is by the combination of horizons that make up that soil, the combination of layers. Not every soil has every horizon, and not every horizon, not every layer within the soil is equally well developed. Now, one of the most important things to remember in the development of soil is the role of vegetation. Let's think about soil here and a tree growing in that soil. And it's got roots going down into the soil. The plants take nutrients out of the soil, the nutrients that they need to grow, and then they use those nutrients to grow leaves and woody stems and bark. And then when the leaves fall off the tree, when the leaves fall down to the ground, then those leaves decompose and the nutrients that are in the leaves go back into the soil, where they can be reused again over and over. Ecologists refer to this as nutrient cycling. In other words, the nutrients from the soil go up into the vegetation and then back into the soil, and they're used over and over again. And that nutrient cycling is what maintains the fertility of the soil. When we talk about a soil having high fertility, it's a soil that has a lot of nutrients in it. And the vegetation is very important to maintaining that fertility within the soil, because it's the vegetation that provides the loose plant material that decomposes and adds the nutrients back into the soil. Now, this is all a very quick and general sort of scientific introduction to what soil is. It's more complicated than just dirt. What I'd like to do now is turn our attention from what soil is to what sort of things people do to the soil that harm it. And there are several general categories that I'd like to focus on. The first is what we might call soil burnout, which means that all the nutrients get used up out of the soil. Let's go back to our diagram here. Think about what happens in agriculture, in farming. When you grow plants on a farm, corn or wheat or beans or peas, Once the plants are grown, then you harvest those plants, take them away, and the nutrients don't go back into the soil. If you take away the plants, there's no return of the nutrients in this nutrient cycle. They just get carted off, and the nutrients from the soil in California end up getting flushed down the toilets in New York City. There's no natural return of the nutrients to the soil. Well, if that happens over and over, if you grow a new crop and take that plant material away, and then next year you grow another crop and take those plants away, eventually you use up all the nutrients in the soil. And once that happens, then we say that the soil is burnt out. Well, what can you do about that? The traditional way of dealing with that problem is to allow a period of fallow, which means you allow the land to sit idle for 2 or 3 or 4 years until those nutrients build back up again. So maybe you grow crops for a couple of years, and then you allow the land to sit in pasture for a couple of years, and then a couple more years of crop and a couple more years of pasture. That way there is some natural regeneration, a resupply of the nutrients to the soil. The modern answer to this problem of soil burnout is fertilizer. If you take the nutrients out of the soil, then you get some chemicals and put the chemicals back into the soil to replace those nutrients. Well, that works fairly well. I mean, it does allow you to continue to grow crops on the soil year after year. The problem is that fertilizers are expensive. They cost money to produce, they use energy to produce, and they use energy when you apply them on the field. So it's an expensive alternative to fallowing, to allow the soil to regenerate on its own. Now, one place where soil burnout is a very big problem is in the tropical areas, the tropical rainforest. Whenever you go to Brazil or Central Africa and you see these giant trees in the tropical rainforest, trees that are hundreds of feet tall and maybe as big around as this fireplace ring. As soon as you see trees like that, the natural thought is to assume, well, the soil must be really good here. Look how big the plants are. When in fact, the soil in the tropics is not very good. And most of the nutrients in the tropics are in the vegetation. And whenever a leaf falls in the tropics, it decomposes very, very fast. And the nutrients are taken right back up by the vegetation so that they don't get washed out of the soil. Well, when you come along and clear away the rainforest, then you take away all the nutrients from that ecological system. And within a couple of years, the soil in the tropics, after you clear away the trees, is virtually worthless because there are no nutrients there. And the soil is so poor that even if you put fertilizers in, it doesn't hold the nutrients very well. So tropical agriculture is very, very difficult because of the nature of the soils in those areas. Now, a second problem, which is related, is soil erosion. Soil erosion also occurs when you remove the vegetation, particularly for agriculture. Because the vegetation protects the soil, the roots help hold it in place, and the leaves of the plants shield the soil from raindrops and prevent erosion from happening very quickly. Well, when you cut down the vegetation, then you expose the soil to water and to rain and to wind. And that wind and water takes away the topsoil, starts to carry away the upper layer of the soil. That's soil erosion. It's a natural process, but when people remove the vegetation, then that natural process is very much accelerated. We know the effects of that from the Dust Bowl, for example, in the 30s. large areas of the Great Plains had the natural prairie grasses removed for agriculture, and then the soil was exposed to the wind, and the wind carried away the topsoil, creating great dust clouds and ruining many farms in the Great Plains, at least for a long time. We see the effects of erosion today in the muddy Mississippi River. The Mississippi River is muddy because a lot of our topsoil from the Midwest is going right down the river into the Gulf of Mexico. Erosion is measured in tons of soil per acre per year. So if you can imagine that a 40-acre farm might be losing 2 or 3 tons of soil per acre per year, that's a lot of topsoil going down the Mississippi River. And if you add all the farms together, the Midwest is losing a big chunk of its precious resource. Well, there are two kinds of responses to soil erosion. One response is conservation, soil conservation. And in soil conservation, what you try to do is farm in such a way that it minimizes the erosion. One way to do that is to plow across a hillside rather than up and down a hillside. Because when you plow across the hillside, then that helps to slow down the water as it runs over the hill. Another way is to use what's called strip cropping, so that maybe you've got a strip of corn and a strip of alfalfa and a strip of oats and maybe another strip of corn. And again, in tiny strips, particularly when they follow the hillside rather than going up and down the hillside, that too helps to reduce erosion, reduce the amount of water running across the hillside. In flat areas, you might think, well, there's not going to be any erosion problem in a flat area. But again, then you have to start worrying about wind, particularly because in flat areas, people want to have big, big farms because they don't have any hills to worry about. But the bigger the field, the more the possibility of wind erosion. So in that case, a way to prevent it would be to plant little belts of trees, shelter belts, to break up the wind and slow it down and reduce the amount of wind erosion. Well, every time you do one of these, it makes the farming process less efficient. Kind of slows down, it gets in the way of the farming process because you're working with smaller fields, smaller plots of land and little tiny strips instead of big fields that are all the same. So the modern high-tech solution to soil erosion is just to add fertilizer. Now we're in soil erosion, the topsoil is the stuff that goes first. And the topsoil is the productive part of the soil as far as agriculture goes. Well, if the topsoil blows away or washes away and all the nutrients get washed away, we'll just take our chemicals and add more nutrients to the soil and that'll solve the problem. Well, there is some sense to that, except that the subsoil is never quite as productive as the topsoil. And again, remember that when you add fertilizer, it's very expensive in terms of the money to produce the fertilizer and the energy that's used to put on the fertilizer. So it is a possible solution, but an expensive one, and one that ultimately decreases the productivity of the land. And this is a great battle that's been taking place over the last couple decades in agriculture. Which solution do we work on, the conservation solution or the fertilizer solution? And these two schools of thought have been battling back and forth with each other for many years. And for the most part, the fertilizer group is the one that wins. The high-tech, the high-intensity farming methods are the ones that tend to win out because they have the chemical companies, they've got the tractor companies all behind them, because if you use more fertilizer, you're going to use more of their products. And so naturally, they would prefer you picked the second solution, not the first solution. Now, agriculture is not the only thing that causes soil erosion. It's a problem here in the West with forestry, with cutting down trees, because again, you're removing the natural vegetation and exposing the soil to the effects of erosion. It's also a problem in construction areas where you're building new homes or new shopping malls or new subdivisions. Because again, you're taking away that natural vegetation cover and you're exposing the soil to the effects of water and wind. Okay, we've talked so far about soil burnout, soil erosion. A third problem is soil compaction. Remember I said that soil has a lot of air space in it. That air space is important because it lets air get to the plant roots, and that's important when they grow. And year after year, when you drive heavy equipment across the soil, big tractors and big plows, and you churn up the soil and then compact it down more and more, you lose a lot of that air space. In addition to inhibiting the growth of plants, when the soil gets compacted, then it's harder for the water to soak in, so that the soil has a tendency to be drier. And if the water doesn't soak in, then it has more of a tendency to run off across the surface of the soil, which leads to more erosion. So you don't want the soil ever to get too compacted, if you can help it. A fourth example of a problem occurs in dry areas where irrigation agriculture is used, in desert areas, such as Southern California or Arizona or Southern Texas, where the soil is pretty good. The soil has a lot of nutrients in those areas. It's pretty fertile soil, but you need to add a lot of water in order for plants to grow in those dry conditions. Well, when water evaporates from the surface of the soil, it leaves behind salt deposits. And eventually, year after year after year, there's a buildup of salt on the surface of the soil. And eventually that salt poisons the soil in such a way that plants can't grow there anymore. A solution to that is to periodically flush away all the salts with big floods of water so that you essentially wash the salt away from the surface of the soil. That works, except that it uses a lot of water. And in desert areas, water can be very expensive. That's the thing that's in short supply in those areas. So the way, these are just four brief examples of things that people do to the soil, but each of them involves a use of the soil that ultimately makes it less productive and ultimately threatens to decrease the amount of food that we can expect to get from the soil. Now, the soil-forming processes that I talked about earlier go on and on and on and on. They are a continuous process. So soil is a renewable resource. But the processes operate very slowly. And in this country and in many other places, we tend to use up the soil resource faster than it can be renewed. And the longer we keep doing that, the more and more we threaten our food production capabilities. And for long-term sustainable agriculture, we need to pay more attention to the way that we treat our soil resource. That concludes my formal presentation, so to speak, but I hope that maybe what I've said has raised some questions for you, and we could maybe take some time now to chat about those. Yes?
Maybe it'd be better if the government would pay farmers to put their cropland into fallow for a couple of years instead of giving them all these other benefits.
Well, in fact, that's one of the programs that the government does use.
Yeah, but for 10 years?
Not for 10 years, no. But they will pay them for a season not to produce. In part, that is for the soil's sake, and in part, that is to decrease the production and increase the prices for the crop. So in one way it works as a price support, in another way it works for conservation.
But a lot of them for 10 years.
But it that is one way that the government has tried to address the problem, is to encourage farmers, one, to not use parts of their farm periodically, to put them in fallow for a while, and particularly not to use what some people call marginal land, land that's very susceptible to erosion, and to encourage farmers to use conservation. They also have been attempting tax incentives if a farmer will use conservation farming rather than ignoring that. So there are some programs to try and encourage that. And certainly education and the extension service has been an important part of trying to encourage soil conservation throughout the years.
Would you, let's see, I have an idea. It's in a strange place, no doubt. But I can remember the 30s when the government came in and put the shelter belts of trees. This was excellent. But then the farmers, and here is the thing, you probably know how much soil, the thinness of a dime per acre, there's a tremendous amount of law. Mm-hmm. If that blows away in dust.
Right.
And my feeling is that if America, if the world is to survive, that we must put the government failed to do this, because then the farmers got the shelter belts worked very fine. But then the farmers got greedy and they tore the shelter belts out.
Wanted bigger fields.
And my feeling is that if we are to survive as an agricultural nation, we must have land use planning on a federal level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that may be right.
And that's the only way we're going to protect our soil. And sure, we can fertilize a lot, and we do, and then there's certain chemicals that they use that really make the soil sterile.
And the other problem with fertilizers is that you get problems of water pollution in the groundwater and in the streams and lakes, and that's become increasingly a problem in rural areas.
You find from what I've heard that fertilizer levels will build up in drinking water to the point where it can be almost toxic or at least poisonous, certainly to little children. Mm-hmm. But they can't drink that at all.
No. To run off into the streams and also soaking down gradually into the groundwater. That's exactly right.
One solution would be for the government to put those soil or shelter belts in, and that had an agreement that they couldn't take them out. And then another thing, there was a program that they allow them to drain all of the lakes and swamps and one thing and another, and this, then they put it into farming, and this cuts down your evaporation and your rain and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. When you do that.
Particularly when they start draining wetland areas, mm-hmm. Then those are important areas where water seeps back into the groundwater system for wells. And when you start draining wetlands for farming, which has been popular in the Midwest, you're taking away part of the groundwater resource. And
I understand that the water level has gone down and down in most of the Midwest. Is that true?
Yes, in the Great Plains areas, particularly Nebraska and the Dakotas and western Kansas, eastern Colorado, Again, from irrigation agriculture, they pump so much water out of their wells for watering the crops that it has lowered the water table tremendously in that region. And there's been an increase in legislation to try and control that groundwater use. But again, when we start talking about what we need to do to control soil erosion and some of these other problems, we also have to keep in mind the nature of the farm economy over the last decade or so, and remind ourselves that even plowing up their shelter belts and increasing the size of their fields, many farmers have been have had difficult times getting by financially. And it's not easy to go in to an area where farmers are struggling financially and then impose on them these conservation measures and say, you have to cut back on your farming operation to protect our soil resource. If they cut back, they may be in danger of bankruptcy, of folding their operations. So that the solutions for the problem are not always easy because of this complex farm economy that we've developed in this country. And so any efforts to control, some of your ideas are quite good with the shelter belts and encouraging conservation, but if you encourage conservation, you also have to do something to encourage the farm economy. And so that national agricultural policy has to cope with a lot of complex relationships when it's made.
Given the high cost of, say, artificially produced fertilizers, what would be some of the financial or practical ramifications of using, say, the output from sewage treatment plants mm-hmm. as a lower cost source of fertilizer or a more natural source?
That has certainly been used in limited experiments so far, where you take the sewage effluent, spray it out on the fields. Not only are you getting some irrigation from that, but you're also getting some fertilization that comes from the effluent. And that has been used successfully in some areas. Some of the problems they run into is that nobody wants to live downwind from those fields. you need a way to kind of control some of the less pleasant side effects from that kind of program.
Is that also true of the solid waste that occur?
To a large extent.
Solid material.
Now, one city that's been somewhat successful with this is Milwaukee. And Milwaukee had a program in which they would take the sludge from their sewage system and dry it so that the odors are essentially gone. And then they would bag it up and sell it as fertilizer. They called it Milorganite. And it was just the Milwaukee sewage that had been dried and sold that way.
But they still do that, don't they?
As far as I know, it's been a while since I've had enough contact with that part of Wisconsin to
I've seen
the
stuff in
sure.
Seattle too.
Yeah. And it's pretty widely distributed.
We are doing that in the growing of Christmas trees, and it's all knifed in. And we could do it in agriculture, but you would fight the environmentalists, and a lot of these people would say, what is it for you? So use no fertilizer or anything.
The organic?
Organic farming. And if you can grow it, if you advertise the fact that your Christmas tree was growing organically, you'd get a higher price.
But then you'd probably have higher costs because you have more pests, more problems, more blights, more everything else.
But in Christmas tree and agriculture, forestry, doing a tremendous job. They grow we can produce it for you in probably 5 years, where it takes 10.
How are the Asian countries doing in their stewardship of the soil? Do you think they're doing better than the domestic? And what difference is there really in it?
Well, I'm afraid I can't answer that very well. Anyone else can address that problem, that question a little bit better than I could?
I never heard that Japan, for instance, used commercial fertilizers. It's always more of the organic stuff, and they have a very small agricultural space. They don't produce all the food they need, but they do produce a lot of it, and I just wondered if they're a better steward of the land than we are.
I think they have to be, or they would have been out of business a long time.
No. One example of that kind of stewardship that I've heard from China is that on some of the communes, they will arrange their various food production techniques in such a way that one feeds into the other. For example, they will put their pigs in cages over the rice paddies so that the hog manure then becomes food for carp that are swimming in the rice paddies, and the carp then help to fertilize the rice paddies, so that you've got the fertilizer kind of cascading down through the various food production systems. But I'm not sure that that's used very widely. I just know that it has been experimented with.
I have something much more basic. What is the advantage, or which is the best way to cultivate, or is it better not to cultivate, say, a corn crop or a bean crop versus herbicide spraying? In some areas, or some farmers, I think it's their choice to not cultivate, usually dairy farmers that don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one, and then I've heard cultivating isn't as good. What's your opinion, or what is the,
well,
in terms of land stewardship, which would be the best?
I think in terms of preserving the soil, the no-tilling techniques have been reasonably effective. I think they do have somewhat more of a problem with weeds after 2 or 3 years of that, so it may be necessary after a couple of years of that to plow more extensively. But on a short term, by leaving the stubble from the
previous... I'm not talking about plowing as much as I am cultivating.
What's cultivating?
Well, that's where you go and you take the weeds out.
Disking out the weeds, okay.
Growing.
Cultivate or color?
Cultivate.
Cultivate. Oh.
Okay, Jerry, you want to...
Cultivating is also digging it out.
Sure it is.
But then the soil is more susceptible to wind erosion, but then it's also more apt to let oxygen and water soak in. Even when it does rain.
There's a lot of no-till farming up in our area in the northwest part of Illinois. And the farmers really do not complain about a loss in their, you know, that they get less produce than what they do in ordinary digging up. And it really has changed, it has changed a lot of the erosion in the streams and lakes.
So is that no-till, though, is that actually not plowing in the fall?
That's right. Oh, they don't plow it. And they don't plow it in the spring. They go through and plant over the stuff.
So the stubble remains from year to year.
One thing they may find out is that they have a lot less wear and tear and fuel consumption on their machine.
That's right. Yeah.
So if they have lower inputs, then that does help their profit margin, or they don't have to get as great a profit. Can anybody explain ridge till farming that, remember Bill Royce that was here a couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
Farmer from...
I wasn't able to
he talked about practicing a ridge and till, or... And I wonder if anybody knows what that is actually. Do you?
Very little knowledge of the subject, but you plant on the ridge.
You create a ridge,
yes,
like of a furrow.
Yeah. When you plow, it's like hilling potatoes. You keep moving the dirt into a ridge, and you plant on the ridge. Then you water in the little valley between each row. If you want to water, and you put your nutrients in that ditch too. That's about all I know about it.
Yeah, well, thank you.
To me, it seems like it's difficult to stay on that ridge. But I guess farming is precision enough nowadays with the machinery they have, they can stay there.
A farmway, though, some of those ridges are as wide as this room. You know, they plant them up here, and then down here they have another layer. You know, and you really, it looks like it's, for, you know, efficient.
Is that like a raised garden, like you
well,
have in your
yeah.
backyard, where you,
some, right.
you get higher efficiency sometimes?
We've got a lot of hills up there, and so yeah. they'll farm one layer here, and then down lower level, they'll farm another.
You follow a contour to it?
Follow the contour.
Yeah.
Contour planning is really effective.
That's a lot like some practices in Asia, isn't it, where you...
Terraces.
There is a bit of controversy about how long you can go with no-till. Every so often, there are some schools of thought that say every 5 years or approximately, that's depending on your conditions, you've got to turn the soil over again and level the thing and start all over with your no-till or partial till.
Go ahead.
You mentioned earlier irrigation in many cases bringing up a lot of salt out of the groundwater. I know that it seems to be the only way you ever see this is where you have these big sprinklers, big circles as an example, spraying just huge amounts of water all over the place, and I'm sure they have a tremendous evaporation factor.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the Israelis have worked a lot with drip type of, or mm-hmm. dribble type of irrigation or something like that. Is anybody trying that, like retrofitting one of these big circles with maybe some sort of downspouts or something to dribble or spray? I'm sure you'd have.
It would be
a fraction of the evaporation.
A more efficient, particularly if the irrigation was taking place at night.
Yeah.
And then
they're using a lot of drip system in Arizona.
Yeah, mm-hmm. California.
And another thing, I went over to New Zealand and I saw all of these hedgerows, and I said to this fellow, what is this, a carryover from England? They have a hedgerow. He said they do that to cut down the wind and evaporation. And maybe this would be, well, I don't know. When you have your shelter belt, they have the same thing.
Yeah. That's one of the other things that go along with more wind is also more evaporation, right?
Well, I was just wondering, given that we're in the business basically of reconstructing soil because we take so much out of it, what is the most efficient way of regenerating soil or getting these natural processes to occur? Is there anything that really is effective, or are we stuck with the slow process?
Maybe there's an element of greed involved there.
Yeah.
Or lack of stewardship, whichever way you want to put. If you throw that in there, or if you can take all that out, well, then I think he's already given the answer.
Yeah.
But if you throw it back in, is there an answer?
Yeah.
On large scale, I think periodic fallow times, not the whole farm at once, but field by field maybe. On a small scale, then you can start to think about composting, because taking the decaying food and plant material and working that back into the soil to replace some of the organic matter. And the organics in the soil really provide a lot of that air space and a lot of the possibility for the water to soak in. And that may be one of the solutions that comes from the sewage disposal problem we were just talking about earlier. Maybe taking some of that dried sludge and working that in, not just spraying it on the surface where it creates other problems, but after it's on the surface, then working it in where it can help to rebuild the structure of the soil.
In Western Washington, they grow cover crops like ryegrass. What's an odd farm that if you grow it in the wintertime, and then you can plow it under.
Plow that back under, yeah. Particularly if it's a crop that helps to replace some of the fertilizers in the soil, like certain alfalfa crops will help to replace the nitrates in the soil because of the nature of their root system. And then once the crop is grown, then plow that under, and that provides some organic matter. You
know. With the desire to get more production out of the soil, though, is there more and more chemicals being used now. Here a few years ago, they were already experimenting, I don't know how far it's gone, it would mean a change in farming equipment and everything else, to narrow the rows in corn. Hmm. They've already done that, like I say, not to any extent, because I don't know what the regular corn spacing is in a row of corn, some farmer could tell me, and that's been that way as long as I know. Now they're experimenting, we'll get extra rows, which is more production, and that's going to take more out of the soil, which means they're going to pour more chemicals back in there to get more production.
Say if you inherit a farm that's just a mess, say your A horizon's gone, your B horizon's all or mostly gone, you've got just this mess that looks like concrete, can you reasonably hope to revive that, no matter what you plant on it, in less than a couple of generations? Because I know you can plant the alfalfa or the, let's say, clover or whatever in the world on there, and then leave it alone. But I mean, you've got just basically almost nothing. Can you make something like that work?
Well, if, as we were talking about earlier, if you could work some of that organic matter into the soil periodically, and then let it grow up some more, so that you were building the organic matter down into the soil. By natural processes, A horizons in a Midwest climate tend to form in about 50 years or so.
So, at least two generations. Yeah,
right. So when you consider an A horizon, how much is that, maybe 4 or 6 inches?
Yeah, in that neighborhood, yeah.
Good for
you. Well, we can look at the tailings up here and see how the soil is forming there.
No. Well, yeah. In part it's the chemical nature of those tailings that inhibits it, but in part it's this climate. We're in a cool climate that inhibits the decomposition of vegetation, where most of the vegetation here is evergreen, so it doesn't provide a lot of plant litter. Those factors together mean that any of the soils around here are pretty thin. When I dug up the soil sample I was passing around, there wasn't much of that there before you got down into the subsoil conditions or parent material.
What do you think of the prospects of the Forest Service plan for revegetating the tailings?
Well, they're gonna need a fair bit of fertilizer to help them out on that process, I think. As I understand it, they intend to cover the tailings with gravel and then plant in isolated places.
Quarter acre islands, I think.
Right, so that with the hope that those will spread outward from there. But in the islands where they do their planting, they're going to have to add some topsoil and fertilizer to make it work.
What is the reason right now that nothing is growing there? I have heard that some of the tailings, at least, were treated with a cyanide solution to dissolve the copper out. I know that's how gold is processed, and like heat bleaching or something like that. Do you know what process they used here? Was it?
There was a similar kind of process. Yeah.
So we've got a lot of really neat stuff in there.
Yeah.
That would kill anything on contact. Then.
Well, when it was originally laid down, perhaps. It continues to be a problem as water seeps through those tailings. It continues to be a pollution problem.
Doesn't the cyanide wash out? Hasn't that washed out pretty quickly?
For the most part, yeah.
I think there's some misconceptions about the cyanide level in the tailings.
You know, it's less a continuing problem than it was initially. Mitch?
Well, I was told that the main problem with the tailings there are pretty impermeable. Water doesn't soak into it readily. Either it just runs off or it stands instead of soaking in.
Yeah, because of the way it was compacted as it was deposited.
So that's...
Warned that those tailings are pretty acid as far as that goes. They've got to neutralize them before the opening plants grow it. They've got to add a lot of something,
yeah,
or else take it away. And the wind is taking it away very often, very quick.
I've read some, I don't know where, how much, or how often, but over the years that there are certain microorganisms that encourage this age to form in your vegetation that you. What can you generate these microorganisms and haul them in and dump them on your field to hurry it up?
That may be a possibility. I don't know.
I don't know what they are, but I've heard about it. But I don't.
I think that they are. One of the problems is that pesticides tend to be kind of hard on those microorganisms, and that inhibits.
A lot of these people feel that, well, that horse manure and cow manure is bad. Is it bad?
When it sits in a concentrated
location. You're plowing it back on the field.
As long as it's not allowed to run off into the streams, mm-hmm. That's where it becomes a problem, is in streams and lakes. But as a fertilizer, no, it's not a problem. As long as it's used right.
Yeah, and one farmer in our country over there, not from Washington, he wasn't doing too well, and he sold all of his topsoil to a company that, and I don't know, they bag it and sell it, but they went clear down to Hardpan. No, in 50 years, you'll have another.
Well.
I will.
He'll have a minimal amount.
Well, essentially, that's what's happening when you grow sod.
Yeah.
They're taking the good stuff off the top with the grass roots. And so they plant another layer of seed, and they tear off another 2 or 3 inches with their sod. So.
Yeah, you can only do that in certain locations where you've got real thick topsoil to work with.
No, you don't. I mean, on our way in that, they
still do it with that?
And there's maybe 6 inches at the most of topsoil, and then it's clay.
Oof.
And they just add enough fertilizers into it that they grow the next crop, and of course, that's sod anymore, and that is, you know, they're lucky if there's an inch of soil to it. I mean,
they cut it pretty
soil, really, it's really all grass at the top and red root system, very little soil involved, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all. Go ahead.
Last week, there was a geologist or something. Went into the tailings, and they discovered there's gold in the tailings. They don't know how to get it out. But the it's the last, let's see, the Forest Service and the Holden have to be very, very gentle on that, because the if the let's see, the tailings are in the land, the forest land. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who told me, but it was the he told us that it was they had the surveyor come on in and.
Yeah, they've had him tested just recently. So that may be one solution, is to work with a mining company. Again, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.